Welcome to the second episode of the Bitcoin 101 podcast. Today, I have the pleasure of having Dan D'Amico with me. He is the Associate Director of the Political Theory Project and a lecturer of economics at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. Dan, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here, David. Good to see you again.
Same here. So Dan and I met in 2004 when I was an intern at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. So that kind of set me on this whole track of, I mean, I was libertarian-ish at the time, which is the whole reason I was an intern. I came there to build their website. But at the end of my summer doing technical work, I attended two back-to-back sessions of Mises University. And that was my first exposure to Austrian economics. So I think without that, I mean, first of all, I would not be successful in Nestor, but more importantly, I would not have understood the importance of sound money. Now I got into Bitcoin, I would say pretty late. You know, it's all relative, but late 2013. But nevertheless, the reason I got into it is because I understood that this was a big deal because it was hard money you can't mess with. And that was important. So I think you and I spent many hours in 2004 talking economics. And so that was definitely a positive influence on me.
Yeah, that was, I mean, there's a number of us from like 04, 05, summer fellowships and the Mises University programs who've sort of made careers in the intellectual space. And it's sort of, starstruck, shocking to think about how long we've known each other in that sense.
For sure.
And I've been a big fan of all the sort of stepping stones through your career and paid a lot of attention, if only because you're like the resident tech aficionado. And I think I remember you like cleaned up a laptop for me back then and it worked like infinitely better. And I was like, this person has skill and they know what they're doing. That's great.
Yeah, I've worked on for people that don't know me, I worked on a number of libertarian websites. I built Lou Rockwell's first blog in 2002 or something. Then I ran Mises.org for 10 years. Then I ran, I founded Liberty.me. Then I ran the feed.org website. And now I'm focused on Bitcoin. So in any case, I haven't followed too closely the attitude that the Austrian economics community has in response to Bitcoin. So by the way, you would say you were an Austrian economist, right?
I'm definitely heavily trained in Austrianism. My own work draws most heavily from F.A. Hayek.
Okay.
And
who is at the top of the trifecta of economists behind you?
Hayek is major on how I look at everything. In particular, I would say the reason why I have an interest in things like Bitcoin and sound money, like you're talking about, is because a lot of my work since my dissertation is focused on this question of optimal punishments in society and understanding and looking at criminal justice error as a sort of overinvestment of public resources, mass incarceration, over criminalization, things like that. And a lot of that, a lot of the way in which economists especially think about punishment is as a price mechanism, that like you're raising the cost of crime, you're trying to deter it. And so there's a very similar dynamic in the Austrian story about central authority manipulating the money supply and therefore manipulating the ratios of capital assets and wealth, and therefore the information stock of the entrepreneurial class and the consumer class in how they understand the relative values of the different things throughout the economy. And I think that there's something very, very similar that happens in the criminal justice sphere, where this sort of huge budgetary subsidies by the federal and local governments into technologies like incarceration and the outfitting of police patrol has a manipulative effect about how communities on the ground actually like resolve social disorder and structure patrolling and security resources in a very similar sort of like manipulation, malinvestment story going on in the criminal justice sphere.
So what's an example of how criminal justice, the misallocation of resources creates negative outcomes?
Well, I mean, for one example, and this has been known since like beyond Austrian economics, since Adam Smith, if you equivocate the penalty for petty crime as serious crime, you effectively create an incentive to commit more serious crime.
Mm.
So if you're going to get charged with 50 years in jail, regardless of whether or not you rob a store or rob a store and shoot the clerk, shooting the clerk leaves no witnesses, right?
Got it.
So by failing to sort of proportionalize the difference in the severity of the crime with a sort of adaptive mechanism, you end up encouraging the violent behavior.
Got it. So getting back to Bitcoin, right behind you, for the people listening, you have three economist portraits. And at the top, you have F.A. Hayek. And then Baum Bawerk on the right?
That is Karl Menger, I believe.
Karl Menger, okay. And then Mises on the left.
Ludwig von Mises, sorry.
Oh, got
I'm
it.
In the way.
No, it's okay. It's okay. So it's interesting is that F.A. Hayek envisioned the idea of Bitcoin many years before it was invented.
Denationalization of money. I haven't read that in decades, but...
So I'm going to quote two sentences from that book. So F.A. Hayek said in 1984, the great trouble is that money wasn't allowed to develop. After 200 years of the use of coins, government stopped any further development. We're not allowed to experiment on it, so money has not improved. It has become worse in the course of time. And then he said, this is the interesting part that gives him a lot of fans in the Bitcoin space. I don't believe that we shall ever have a good money again before we take the thing out of the hands of the government. That is, we can't take them violently out of the hands of government. All we can do is by some sly roundabout way, introduce something that they can't stop. So
yeah, I've seen a couple clips recently of Friedman saying very similar things. Basically, early in the lifespan of the internet, there's an interview where he was saying that the internet is going to make evading or avoiding tax incidents very easily because you've got this sort of seamless peer-to-peer interconnection. So people could contract and sort of barter and exchange goods and services without the sort of like knowing. It's basically like the ease with which cash transfers in the prior internet economy could avoid taxation.
Of course, it's one thing to say that somehow technology will allow us to have a private money, but it's a major invention to actually create a system that lets us do that, which Satoshi Nakamoto did. But getting back to the theory, from your perspective, why is it important to have a money that's not controlled by the government?
Well, I think prior to that issue, the importance of just sound money, it conceptually is possible that a government could have a sound money. So the answer to your question is just whether or not it's probable that a government is going to maintain the principles of the sound money. So the importance of monetary soundness, I think, is in a Hayekian vein, is epistemological, is that your money supply is an information conduit so that people can make investment, consumption, and production decisions in an informed and accurate way, that they're acting upon the signals of, oh, this is worth a lot and therefore I want to make more of it and sell it and put it on the market, all of that information gets really screwed up if the money isn't sound, meaning that people can sort of manipulate the supply or stock of it willy-nilly. People can sort of just add counterfeit notes to a system. You're effectively robbing people of the capital value in relative terms to like other assets in the economy when you do that. So it's not necessarily always and everywhere that we just don't want government to have anything to do with money. It's instead this sort of like soundness on the one hand. But the question is like, if you give central authority, if you give any individual person or any individual entity this sort of sole discretionary power to adhere to soundness or deviate, it's very enticing. It's very, James Buchanan is a Nobel Prize winner in public choice economics. He has this quip, well, don't let the fox guard the chicken coop. Like, it's in the nature of any centralized authority. Like, if I said, David, you have all ability to control the money supply, I'd print myself some free money. I'd give away free money to my friends and family and those sort of things. I would manipulate it in such a way that promoted my interests, however they might be defined. So admittedly, I was a huge Bitcoin skeptic when it first came out, because it seemed like there was this sort of cloak and dagger mystery behind, you said his name, I don't even know.
Satoshi Nakamoto.
Satoshi Nakamoto. I mean, rest assured, the day that Dan D'Amico invents a digital currency, you should expect that Dan D'Amico has a backdoor to sort of give myself extra digital credits and sort of cheat the system down the line. I don't know. I mean, I am not like you. I don't speak the code, so I can't speak to the sort of like elegance or the beauty of the technology and whether or not it mitigates concerns of that nature.
So back to what you said earlier, if I can try to rephrase one of your points, the problem is that it's too tempting for politicians that control money to print money to enable more spending, as opposed to raising taxes, right? Is that the key issue?
Well, I think a monetary idealist would be like, but that's not an issue because we have the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve is independent of politics. I think that's pretty naive. I think they're in much the same way as we like to sort of pretend or hope for an idealized independent judiciary, like the Supreme Court is independent of politics. There's obviously sort of cracks in that system. There's obviously sort of a permeable membrane by which politics does have manipulative influence. So one example is like political business cycles are a phenomenon that economists talk about pretty regularly, where the incentives of partisan cycling in democratic processes are such that if you're going to have two terms as president, 4 years and 4 years, right when you get in office, you've got a lot of incentive to sort of give away free goodies. Either that's expand the money supply, increase public spending, like give away stuff to your constituency. It seems really great, high on the hog type stuff. But if you have foresight that the other political party is going to get in office after you, then you have strong incentive to sort of set in place things that might tank the economy so that when they take an office, everybody thinks it's really crummy and bad. Now, how much politicians have the real ability to sort of manipulate or bully or manhandle the Federal Reserve? I mean, I'm not in on those meetings per se, but it definitely seems that it's not zero.
So from my perspective, fiat money has three basic problems. I like to always group whatever it is into three categories. So first problem is that inflation happens over time. And it's been pretty slow for the last few decades, I think. But the dollar has lost at this point 96% of its value since the Federal Reserve was founded in 1913. So by itself, that's not a huge deal. But the second issue, as you talked about, is that by arbitrarily basically giving money to politically powerful causes and pressure groups, there's all kinds of misallocation of resources. And it's a allocation that voters don't really have the ability to see or control because it's not collected through taxes. The government is basically able to print money and give it to banks or give it to government spending programs. And because it's not done through taxation, has very little oversight. And the third issue, and I would say maybe the biggest issue, is that historically we know that all fiat money systems eventually collapse. And usually, it's not always through how hyperinflation. Some regimes are just overthrown, the country disappears. But quite often, the fiat money system ends up being devalued to nothing because you have this inflationary cycle where the government must print more and more money to maintain the spending levels.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I would state the third claim as strongly as you did, meaning that fiats always collapse. I mean, that would seem to be a byproduct of the time framing that you're talking about. I mean, we live in a world propagated by lots of fiat currencies, many, if not most of which, don't appear on the brink of collapse per se. But I do think it's true that fiat currencies have a proclivity and or potential for collapse in a way that monetary soundness or commodity currencies or gold or things of historic relevance just are not as victim to.
And maybe you should say these reserve currencies tend to collapse, like global or regional currencies.
Well, I would definitely say that reserve currencies and fiat currencies, in addition to the potential for collapse, also have the potential for business cycle malinvestments. And so apart from just the malinvestment insofar as like you're getting technologies and sort of industries that like otherwise probably wouldn't exist and are just sort of this artificial creation of free money, so to speak, there are sort of hazards to that process where they collapse and real social consequences that are associated with that.
So I would like to say that both governments and the Bitcoin community are human institutions, and no institution is perfect. But the real question is, what incentives does the system create? So whereas with fiat money, the incentive is for politicians to create more of it to fund programs, Bitcoin has a very different incentive structure. And so, for example, you mentioned that you were wondering if Bitcoin has a backdoor that would allow Satoshi to print or exploit the money. And what's interesting is that there's a very interesting incentive set up in the system. So, for example, Bitcoin at this point is worth over $1 trillion. And so anybody that could find an exploit, a secret exploit, they have a very high monetary reward. And the longer Bitcoin has been around and the more it's worth, the more it's been validated to be secure. Right, because with each year that passes, it becomes more valuable, and there's more time for somebody to find an exploit. And in the, how long has it been? 13 years of its existence, or maybe 12 years, it has never once been hacked.
I'm not sure if it's a good apples to apples comparison, but I suppose I'm sort of making your case for you. It's my understanding that like the printing of physical currency by the Federal Reserve has to radically change the imaging on a regular basis, like every less than 10 years now, precisely because it's hackable. And so effectively people are getting really good at hard counterfeiting in a way that has made their requirement to technologically adapt over and over again very short.
Sorry, I didn't quite get that. So counterfeiters are getting better because of what?
Well, it's not so much that, I mean, they're getting better just inevitably by technological increases. The methods by which the Fed is basically needs to change the images of that are on bills.
Yeah.
It's getting faster and faster and faster. So you point out this 13-year time cap. I can imagine a cynic being like, 13 years is like not that long compared to, say, the the long history of the American dollar, but actually the sort of counterfeit potential of the American dollar is getting to be a shorter and shorter time window.
I see. So, one common question people have is, we've had gold for many thousands of years being used as money. So why is Bitcoin such an innovation? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I do know that the people who care deeply about these definitional debates, is Bitcoin money, is gold money? A lot of it's very semantic insofar as, by definition, if you take like Carl Menger's account on the origins of money very seriously, like what it means is the most commonly accepted form of asset that's accepted across the board. So in that vein, neither gold nor Bitcoin are really contemporarily considered money, insofar as I can't take a chunk of gold into a store and be like, here, give me my groceries. And I can't necessarily do that with Bitcoin either. The leg up on Bitcoin on that dimension is that it's so easily transferable to what is accepted as money, even if that thing is varied, dollars, pounds, Russian sterling, I don't even know that many currencies, but I'm less concerned about that semantic argument. I'm just more interested in whether or not it's a fungible asset that can serve purposes akin to money, because I'm totally content with a sort of piecework sort of quilt of imperfection in that sense.
So I'm not too concerned with definitions, but maybe what I was getting to is, so different assets have different degrees of moneyness. I think that is an actual technical term, where dollars right now are very money, right? It's as money as you can get anywhere in the world. And for example, I was in Malaysia, and Malaysian ringgits, maybe I forget the exact name, are only basically accepted in Malaysia. So when you leave the country, so it's a low moneyness, and dollars have some moneyness, and the Bitcoin has not a lot because there's very few shops that will take it. But besides the moneyness of these assets, there's the intrinsic suitability of the asset as money. So on the day that Bitcoin was invented, it was still great money, like as a concept, even though nobody else in the world accepted it yet.
Yeah, so great divisibility, great sort of like store of verifiability. Like, I mean, basically, like, historically, gold and silver were as such because it's easy to verify if something is real gold or fake gold. It's malleable and sort of easy to specialize or personalize for individual people and be like, oh, I'm verifying the weight relative to other metals and stuff. It's like easy to break apart and sort of make change in that sense. Bitcoin has all those features and then some, right? So yeah, in its logistic potentials, I think out the gate, Bitcoin was a rocket ship in that sense. And beyond that, I mean, so when you're talking, your examples of moneyness were all currencies. Mm-hmm. Other things have moneyness elements too, stocks and bonds, titles, futures contracts. I mean, anything that has verifiable value and a sort of predictable future expected value associated with it. There are exchanges, there are marketplaces where you can sort of cash them in or trade them to other people. And so the logistic potential of Bitcoin, my first reaction was also that, like, wow, you know, like we were just talking about how the Fed is having a difficult time fending off counterfeiters and having to change the sort of imaging on dollars. Most titles, car registrations, leases and assets of real estate, all of that stuff comes on this sort of like fancy money-ish paper because of the logistic challenges that are faced with regard to counterfeiting and with regard to fraud in those environments. And again, Bitcoin just decimates the performance on the replicability, as far as I understand it, which I admit I'm not like a tech guru in this sense, but all of the information I've heard from the people like you that I trust on the technology is that like it's very, very sound in that sense. Like, what is blockchain is a unique technological innovation, regardless of whether or not you're a Bitcoin enthusiast, regardless of what mm-hmm. happens to the price of Bitcoin in the future. The technological capacity of blockchains for contract enforcement, for assuring titles, which is like a major component of economies and trade. It does seem that blockchain is like a very cool thing in that space.
The way I see, I'm sorry, getting back to a previous issue, Bitcoin and gold. Gold is the money for the industrial and pre-industrial economy. And it's very good as money if you're physically meeting people, engaging in trade, then you can have gold certificates and all that. But Bitcoin is money for the information economy. It has all the key aspects of gold, but it's global. It lives naturally on information networks. And a lot of the value in the world today is stored on information networks. And so it's natural that Bitcoin is money for the internet civilization. It's something that we have to have, not just because governments are destroying the value of fiat money, but because the world needs something that's instantly transmissible and infinitely divisible, near infinitely divisible, and has those native internet properties.
Yeah, I mean, I think what the world needs is sort of to be seen in that sense. And so like a large aspect of my optimism about the future potentials of Bitcoin, again, have to do with this seeming logistic superiority over alternative monetary moneyness things. And so you started out the conversation pointing out like, well, you know, inflation is like, is a big deal when you compare it to 1913, but a small deal when you look at recent years, and especially small if you talk to as many like sort of Austrian people, as you and I are probably familiar with, because Austrians since like the 60s and 70s have been sort of like screaming from the rooftops, this deep concern about potential inflation with regard to monetary expansions. And so in especially prior to the 07 crisis, the common adage in Austrian circles that like when I was in grad school, one of our sort of exam questions was like, where's the inflation? Like, you got to have an explanation for this, because otherwise you just look stupid if you're pontificating and predicting this thing that never happens. And so typically the consensus answer was, well, the conventional models of monetary valuation changes and inflation are kind of like a closed system national economy as it relates to other closed system national economies, each using respective fiat currencies. But historic events since the mid-20th century has really globalized the economy. Mm-hmm. So the fact that other countries' currencies have at times collapsed and then they've dollarized has arguably soaked up a lot of the otherwise expected inflation, right? So you don't see domestic price levels shoot up that much if huge percentages of your dollars are going abroad and staying abroad because they're facilitating trades and exchanges there. So to me, the big question of whether or not the world truly needs demonstrated preferences truly needs Bitcoin will be proved by those type of scenarios in the future. The foreign country that has some sort of like local shilling type thing that does collapse, do the people on the ground opt towards Bitcoin or do they opt towards dollarization? If they opt mm-hmm. towards Bitcoin, present holders of Bitcoin stand to gain a lot of wealth as that network expands. And again, I mean, my hunch is that every day that passes, the logistics that shape that decision for that on the ground actor leans a little bit more and more towards Bitcoin. Insofar as like cell phones and internet technology is becoming ubiquitous, I mean, anybody who's anybody is sort of like more and more aware of what these Bitcoin technologies represent and how the value is sort of growing, in contrast to like the Fed saying kind of crazy things on a daily basis. If in the next 50 years, dozens or some smattering of countries' currencies at the local level collapse and huge swaths of people make some meaningful choice, do I want to revert to euros, dollars, or Bitcoin? It seems inevitable that some growing percentage is going to be choosing the latter instead of the former.
It's already legal tender in at least one country, right? In El Salvador.
Yeah, and then Miami is doing a lot of cool stuff.
So I want to get back to a few things you were saying earlier. So as you said, part of the reason that we don't have a lot of inflation is that we're exporting dollars to other countries. But we do have officially legal inflation, as you mentioned, people do use a lot of other assets as money. So real estate, stocks and bonds. And part of the reason that people are using their 401ks as savings instead of keeping in the bank is obviously the low interest rates. Mm-hmm. So now savers are forced to become market speculators, and they're forced to buy real estate because the highest rates they can get at a bank are still losing value every year due to inflation. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the reason that we have low interest rates is because our monetary system has made easy money available to institutions that want to borrow it, both government institutions and banks. Is that a way to think about it?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think the other aspect, like the answer of why we have low interest rates, is largely because interest rates are shaped and designed by central authority.
To do what?
I think in the contemporary moment is to basically fend off whatever social consequences would associate with spiking the interest rate, which would be a reduction in investment, right? So if you're concerned about general economic growth, productivity, new businesses opening up, building new factories, hiring more people, having those low interest rates is going to lubricate all of those endeavors. If those people are instead looking at stuff going, I mean, basically, when an interest rate is high, if you're holding a bunch of capital, you can lend it to someone else. And so only the people whose profit margins are going to be above that interest rate are going to be the ones that actually do stuff. So if you have goals of low unemployment and you have goals of like sort of just, well, we just want to seem like we're making more stuff and expanding and all of those sort of things, you don't want that high interest rate. The higher the interest rate goes, the more cautious sort of like on the ground suppliers are going to be.
The one problem with this is that these rates are creating all this new investment and consumer spending, but there's not the savings to build all the capital infrastructure, to build all the factories to produce all this stuff. And so we have chronic shortages.
With inflation like happening, there's direct disincentive to engage in savings. Right, like every month that goes by, your $1,000 in your savings account is worth less and less.
And there's no way not for the government to raise the rate without creating a recession, which president wants to do. Yeah. So it seems that for the foreseeable future, people will be looking for alternatives to money, to for their savings. And Bitcoin as a savings vehicle is very interesting. So from my perspective, I'm writing an article about this. The natural human nature is to create a better life for yourself than your ancestors. And so economic growth is an expression of the nature of humanity to always better our situation. And if money represents a store of value you've created in the past, you should naturally have deflation of money. If the supply of money is not increasing and human beings are always creating more value, more capital, more production, then anybody that simply holds on to the money should see it appreciate in wealth. That ought to be the natural course of how savings works. Very different from today, where the government tries to maintain a certain inflation rate. What we should see happen is that if we have a fixed supply of money, it should appreciate every year by the average rate of per business profit.
So I saw you had like a brief little Facebook post about this specifically with regard to sort of encouraging people to think of Bitcoin as a preferable venue for your savings account.
Yes.
I find that pretty appealing, but it's paradoxical from the more robust Bitcoin optimist insofar as that with that acknowledgement comes another hard reality that what makes it good for wanting to save might make it bad for your unit of account in a business operation.
Mm-hmm.
Like as a person with a steady stream of income and a salary in like a conventional economy situation, when I get my paycheck once a month or whatever, and I say, okay, I want to put some money in savings and I'm doing that by means of buying Bitcoin. I find that appealing in the logic that you just described. But if I was, instead of just sort of like an employee getting a traditional paycheck, I was an entrepreneur. I had to buy ingredients to sort of make and manufacture something. I had to structure contracts for sales and performance and delivery and all of those things. It would seem that doing all of that in the units of Bitcoin, given the volatility, is very difficult relative to other alternatives.
The volatility does make it difficult. I mean, Bitcoin is not a, how can I put it? It's not a useful money, or it's not the superior money. It's not the superior currency for anybody in a developed country today because of the volatility. Maybe it's a very good investment. And in some countries, it may be the best money. If your local currency is totally collapsed and you don't have access to dollars, for some people, it is the best money. But for most people, maybe it's a great investment. I mean, I think it is a great investment, but it's not good money because it's so volatile. Mm-hmm. And nobody wants to make a loan in Bitcoin because it's going to be worth something very different 10 years from now. It's highly unpredictable.
If at any given point in time the price tanks and then they pay it back,
right, exactly. But I think for me it's interesting to look at the properties of a Bitcoin economy and ask, is that a better system than what we have now, a system with a fixed supply? Now I do think that as Bitcoin adoption grows, the price will stabilize. I mean, it has to. The reason that there's so much volatility is because most of the Bitcoin around today is held by speculators. Whereas in a Bitcoin economy, or at least in the economy where more Bitcoin is used for actual trade and transactions, most of it will not be available to speculators.
Okay, so I find that argument very appealing, but I'm trying to think about what that means for on-the-ground reality. So if I understood what you just said, you're like, okay, speculators are driving the volatility. So if the ratio of people in the Bitcoin network gets more dominated by real users, people buying and selling packs of gum and cars and anything and everything in between, then you're going to be insulated significantly from that volatility because the volatility is the speculation. So how do you accomplish that given the present volatility? Because it would seem like that wide scale adoption is quasi dependent on collapsing alternatives.
Maybe part of what you're asking is it's a chicken and an egg problem. For people to desire to use Bitcoin as money, it has to be stable. But it's not going to be stable until they start using it as money. So this is how I think Bitcoin will win in the long run. In some places, Bitcoin will become the best currency. Now, if you live in a developed country where you have access to bank accounts and debit cards and inflation rate is 2%, though it's not really anywhere near 2% in the US or Europe, if it's reasonable, your fiat money is your best option. But in some countries, people don't have access to bank accounts and they don't have access to sound money. So in Venezuela, the government has somewhat dollarized, but right now, Bitcoin is one of the best ways to work on currency controls. Or in China, have very strict currency controls. The future of the yuan is very uncertain. Every Chinese in China wants to get, if they have money, to get it out of the country just in case, right? And their wealth could be confiscated arbitrarily at any time. So in some places, Bitcoin becomes their best option. Maybe not for the whole country, but in their particular scenario, maybe the party has it out for you. And so one use case at a time, more and more people find it useful. And the more people find it useful, the less speculators there are.
So I think that makes a lot of sense. It seems like everybody there's a consensus amongst like Bitcoin enthusiasts that growing the network of users is a good thing. Maybe this is anecdotal on my part. There's a guy, Eli Duardo. He works for the Mercatus Center. He's given like congressional testimony. He's like really, really into like tech stuff like Bitcoin, as well as like supersonic jets and interesting applied political economy topics. When we were in grad school, he was like a Johnny Appleseed evangelist for Bitcoin. Like, five people go to dinner and you're trying to split the check, he'd be like, check this out, guys, it's so easy. And he'd like put an app on everybody's phone. And like, and there's a certain demographic of people, mainly like at that time, millennials and college students and stuff, that were very comfortable with apps and iPhones and this sort of process of him like, oh, I push this button, everybody got sent this amount of currency, and then they could like convert it really easily. It's a radically different tolerance for that sort of tech savviness amongst like my parents or something like that. Like, my father made his first Amazon purchase like 6 months ago. My first gut reaction when I saw this was like, if you really wanted this to take off, you would try to find networks of people and do like what Eli is doing. And yet today, 13 years later, so to speak, I feel like I see less of that. Fewer people who are like, I mean, you just started this sort of endeavor for yourself, and I think that that's really cool. But I guess apart from just sort of like speaking to people about the merits and the sort of virtues of Bitcoin, like if there was a viable way to be like, here, you're ready to go, right? Like,
sure.
Like with whatever investment, like here's the app, here's the technology, whatever that might be. Now you're a fully functioning commercial agent, buyer, seller, whatever, in a Bitcoin economy. I mean, early on, I thought that, well, the digital, like when Bitcoin first hit the scene, banks didn't have wire transfers on apps nearly to the extent that they do now, and Venmo didn't exist. So like, I feel like both of those innovations sort of took a little bit of the wind out of the Bitcoin sail. Like, if we still didn't have those, I would be far more like, dude, Bitcoin's better because I can send my landlord stuff without having to go to the bank and without having to write a check and all that sort of lo-fi boomer tech. Are there practical efforts of people going into these foreign countries with sort of, I don't know, burner phone equivalents of like Bitcoin transmitters, early markets that I thought would be viable, would be particularly amenable, were things like black market sales, like dealers and whatnot. I was climbing up the walls for COVID, and I dove hard into record collecting again. And I am sort of surprised that none of the people I buy and sell records with on online, on Facebook auctions and stuff, none of them really use Bitcoin. But there are lots of other sort of like dude hobby spaces that use Bitcoin. So like the Mt. Gox was like a big event early on because it got sort of hacked or whatnot. But MTGOX, Magic the Gathering, people found that trading Magic the Gathering cards, that Bitcoin was very effective at sort of facilitating all of the trades that they were trying to do. So like Magic's a big network. Like if you could go into these sort of like hobby spaces and say, if all of you guys were transacting in Bitcoin, a lot of you would be rich right now, and like sort of get that compellingness. And like, but I don't know what that pitch looks like in rhetoric. And I don't know what that pitch looks like in like hard technology or like tacit lessons, if that makes sense.
Those are all good points. By the way, so I help people find lost Bitcoin wallets, and it's quite often that somebody will come to me and say, 10 years ago, I got Bitcoin for my trading cards. Can you help me find it? So it's actually a lot of people like that. So it's a very good point that now we have very convenient apps like Venmo and PayPal to send money, and they make the need for Bitcoin in developed countries less pressing. Now, this still requires a bank account. And there are, I don't know, billions of people that do not have a bank account. I don't know the exact number. And also countries where you can get a bank account, but your currency loses 20-30%. So I think focusing on those parts of the world is definitely very important for Bitcoin to be adopted. Just back to what we were saying earlier. So I accept payment for my service doing Bitcoin consulting and Bitcoin or credit cards. And usually people do credit cards, even though I'm helping them with their Bitcoin, because that's what I asked. Would you mind doing Bitcoin? Then no, for a credit card or debit card. They're holding it for one thing, but also they're used to thinking of Bitcoin as an investment, and credit cards is a payment, and they want to see that payment record on their report. But now you do have these Bitcoin debit cards, right? I don't know if you've heard of this. It's not true Bitcoin because
they still convert to the dollar.
They still convert to the dollar. But I see this as evolving. You just need the point of sale systems to adopt the Lightning Network technology, and we can have native Bitcoin transactions. I think it's an intermediate step. We already have the smartphone. My watch does payments. So it just needs to have the technology built in for a Lightning Network. I remember back in 1994, Bill Gates wrote a book predicting the future. And he said that soon we will have micropayments, where whatever service you consume online, you will pay a micro transaction for that. And now we're almost 25 years later, still don't have good micropayments because there's too many transaction costs. And the chargebacks, the whole infrastructure is too expensive, the micropayments. And as a result, this is my theory, online publishing really sucks. We have really bad funding model for all publishing content online. So I think part of the problem there is that we don't have effective micropayments. And so finally, I think Brave Browser is trying to solve the problem where for each website visit, the publisher gets very tiny portion, and they do that on the blockchain. I think we have a few more minutes. I wanted to ask, what is your strongest criticism of Bitcoin? What do you think are the biggest problems it has?
I think it's very appealing to particular ideological camps, which I actually think like benefited it in its early stages. But people talk about it in terms of like a safety valve of societal collapse or something like that. And it's hard to wrap my head around how a digital payment processing system would function in an environment with unreliable internet or electric access. Granted, it's not the case that gold is necessarily great on that. But gold wouldn't lose value necessarily in that environment. And you could imagine a short run situation where conventional cash would be very, very useful.
Bitcoin is not usable without internet for the most part, but it doesn't lose value. You still have what you own.
Well, it would depend on the expectation of getting electric and internet back to reliability, right? So a situation where it was uncertain as to how reliable your internet connectivity on a global scale or on a regional or whatever large scale would be pretty disruptive to the usefulness of it, in my mind.
I think a very interesting and unexpected development is that today, the vast majority of the world have a cell phone, and pretty soon it will all be smartphones. It's such a powerful force multiplier that I think we should expect pretty much every adult human being to own a cell phone and have internet connectivity. And any country that does not allow that basically will collapse and be replaced by a regime that does it, because it's such a strong force multiplier for human beings to be connected.
Well, I mean, you bring up the word regime, and that would be my second major criticism, would be it is clearly not within the vested interests of our current political establishment to see Bitcoin succeed as much as Bitcoin optimists want it to. So people I know who sort of live and navigate in Washington, D.C., basically argue that the sort of full scale regulation is coming. And so make the money now, so to speak, do the sort of speculation. But in terms of radically reshaping our attitudes and beliefs and sort of entire structure of commerce is unlikely.
So one question is whether Bitcoin will replace the dollar and national fiat regimes. And I don't know, maybe that's unlikely, at least in most countries. But could Bitcoin replace, let's say, gold or real estate or other forms of money-like assets as a savings vehicle? To me, that's more likely. And that's not such a threat to governments. In many ways, Bitcoin is easier to track, because when you want to cash it out, you have to go through a bank and through an exchange, and they can track that, as opposed to actual gold or property. Maybe there's ways to hide that. I think these are all questions, and governments can definitely make it more difficult for Bitcoin. But I don't see, like in China, having an outright war against Bitcoin, because politicians do not see it as such a major threat right now. And I think at this point, many of the bureaucrats running the SEC and other regulatory bodies have some involvement in space. It's such a major innovation. It's too self-destructive for any country to ban it outright. It just destroys their company. Even China is not having second thoughts, read articles about Bitcoin. Because so it's
did
so
China
crippling.
Full out ban it?
They've been banning it since 2013. So I was in China in 2013, Bitcoin, a building exchange. And that's when I heard first commentary on them banning it. And so from over the course of 2013, 15, 17, 18, 2020, and now finally 21, progressively it's been more and more and more.
More restricted.
At this point, theoretically, it's completely banned, not just Bitcoin, but anything with a blockchain. But,
As an economist, I find that really puzzling. So like China's huge, right?
Yeah.
The global nature of the currency would mean that if it was effectively banned, meaning that the legislation had teeth to it, there was a practical reality that people who were doing this yesterday are now no longer doing it. You'd expect the price to tank.
Right, and it didn't. It doubled.
Right, so I don't know whether or not that reflects people calling bullshit on the on the sort of like capacity of the regulation, right? So China says Bitcoin's illegal, but like in reality, everybody actually is still using it who was using it yesterday, and there's really no meaningful enforcement to it. Or if it reflects a sense of like tension and animosity between, like, because of these sort of like ideological cohorts who are like, okay, well, these governments are going crazy with the regulation. That makes me want it like sort of all the much more, because it becomes a sort of symbol and or real venue for sort of counteracting that like oppression or power.
Yeah, I don't think it's ideological. What I do know is that like the number three coin, Binance coin, is I don't want to say Chinese, but it's created by a China-based exchange, and maybe half the top 10 exchanges are China affiliated. So okay. Despite it being banned officially in the mainland, it still seems like you know, maybe half of all crypto ecosystem usage is by various degrees of Chinese users, right?
That's fascinating.
Well, in any case, I think we're about out of time. Any last thoughts or things you want to promote before we sign off?
No, man, I had a great time. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Thanks a lot, Dan. It's been great.
Yep. Best of luck, Dave.
Yep. Bye. I'm going to stop recording here.